Well, hello, everyone. This is Irvin Nugent, and welcome to the Resilient Leadership Podcast, where everything we talk about is aimed at helping you lead with a greater sense of calm, clarity, and conviction, even in these anxious times that we find ourselves. And as always, I am joined by my co-host, collaborator, and friend, Bridget Tyer. Bridget, how are you doing today?
Well, Irvin, thank you for asking. I am doing well. I am thinking about how relevant this topic is for me personally today. I'm facing into some ambiguity in some important arenas in my life. So I'm just glad that, you know, we're diving into this because I think it's going to help me. And I hope it will also help our listeners. So without further ado, Irvin, why don't you give the listeners a little bit more of a sense of what we're going to be talking about?
Sure. So today's topic is making decisions when everything is ambiguous. Now, I wanted to start with a quote from an actress, Gilda Radner, who is an old-time actress, but she once said, "Life is about not knowing, having to change, taking the moment, and making the best of it without knowing what's going to happen next." Delicious ambiguity. I love that. Delicious ambiguity.
She's very optimistic.
Now, we got to say that Gilda is a force all by herself because most people do not put deliciousness and ambiguity together. More often than not, ambiguity is a source of real pain for us as human beings. And it's interesting, you know, studies have shown that, you know, 90% of problems that middle managers and above make are ambiguous. It's neither clear sometimes what the problem is nor what the solution is. And in many ways, and Bridget, I'm sure you know you find this as well, the higher you go up, the more ambiguous things get. Now, you know, in a wonderful situation, given unlimited time, and we had 100% of the information, and we could look back at past decisions, then, you know, we would be able to solve the problems that came before us. But that is not reality. And the reality is we do live in times where either because of the speed of the decision we have to make it quickly without the full information, or else we're just are faced with the reality that we're not quite sure of the full impact of a situation. And so we have to make our best guess. So today, this episode, what we're going to do is we're going to explore, you know, first of all, what's happening in the brain? Something's happening there when we're faced with ambiguity. How do we face these problems with not full information or perhaps the knowledge of the outcome that's going to happen? So, Bridget, I'm curious, when you hear the word ambiguity, what's your relationship with ambiguity?
Well, the first word that would not pop into my head is delicious. I think I do have an aversion to ambiguity, and here's why. I am a person who, I don't know, worked really hard to have clarity, you know, clarity in my communication, clarity in my aims and aspirations and goals, clarity in the way I approach my business, coaching, and I help leaders get clear. I think that's one of my strengths because we know that clarity is extremely important for organizations. So what's the opposite of clarity? Ding, 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 ambiguity. So I think I have a complicated relationship with ambiguity. That would be my bottom line answer. Now, how about you, Irvin?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think like you, there is a certain amount of, you know, of wanting kind of clarity about a decision. However, I have noticed that sometimes I'm willing to make a decision and I know that the story in my head is, even if I don't have all the information, well, if I get it wrong, I'll just make another decision. So I'm not in the sense of I don't necessarily have to have perfection the first time around. I can do it again. But still, I do like a lot of my thinking and around that clarity is really getting to the clarity of what's happening. And I know in my life that there are times when I think I know what the issue is, even personally, what's going on in my life. And then I dig a little deeper and I go, oh, no, it's actually something else. And I think that's taught me to be weary of jumping to conclusions too quickly.
Aha. So you have grown, it sounds to me, over the years in becoming a little bit more comfortable with ambiguity, yes, right?
Very much.
Yeah, so. Yeah. That's awesome. And of course, you know, even still, we know that it's challenging to make a decision in the face of ambiguity, yeah, right? Wouldn't it yeah be nice if we just had all the information and we had a clear path and it was pretty black and white? That's not the way most things go. So you mentioned a couple minutes ago that we were going to look at some neuroscience about this. And I always am inspired when we sort of look into the brain and see what's happening there, because it sheds this light and then we can work with our brains rather than against them. So Irvin, get us into this part of the conversation about what is happening inside the brain in the face of ambiguity.
Well, let's just start by reiterating what we just said, that the most important questions in our lives almost always lack clear answers. Like just for example, like, should you try and get promoted in your current organization or leave and go somewhere else? It's a big question. Or else, should I get married now? Or should I take a few years to be by myself, travel the world and get some experience? These are big questions where the answer isn't always obvious. And the reality is both in our work lives and our personal lives, they're full of ambiguity and uncertainty. And scientists have known just for a long time that as humans, we have this inherent aversion to ambiguity. And the research has shown that, you know, when they're looking at people who make decisions, what we tend to do is choose outcomes that are most predictable over mm-hmm the outcome that is ambiguous. And you know, that's not really surprising. However, in some other research, what is surprising is that people will choose predictable outcomes rather than an ambiguous outcome, which potentially could be clearly more advantageous to us. We like the safety, even though we tend not to make ambiguous decisions, even though it might benefit us most. It's that need for certainty that we've spoken about before that can lead us really to decisions that are not in our best interests.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, because definitely the whole thing about certainty, as we've discussed in a couple of other episodes, the brain craves that. The brain likes certainty in this regard, that it's a predicting making organ. It likes to look for patterns and connections and then uses those patterns and connections to say, oh, this is what is going to happen most likely. And when that prediction comes true, the reward circuit in our brain gets activated and it's a really great feeling. But you know, the reverse is true. Like, if we make a call and it's not the right one, or if the patterns don't add up in a discernible way, the brain senses that and perceives that as a threat.
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of sense that ambiguity and certainty within the brain, you know, kind of trigger some unpleasantness. Mm. Now, I think the question that then becomes interesting, Irvin, is, you know, do we have a sort of hardwired, and I'm a little bit hesitant to even use the term hardwired, because in our last episode, we say the brain's not really hardwired because of its plasticity. What we can suggest is that certain patterns do get, right, embedded into our way of thinking and acting. So do we develop an aversion to ambiguity as just kind of the way the brain functions over time?
So I think it's important to say that again, like you say, you know, because of we can change the brain, but certainly we are created to keep ourselves safe. And what we found is that what neuroscientists have found, that as the ambiguity increases, there is increased activation of this area of the brain we've talked about many times before, the amygdala, which is the home of a lot of our emotional responses. And then also part of the frontal cortex called the oprefrontal cortex, which is associated with emotional processing and fear responses. And then there's also a decline in the reward system in the brain. So the other fascinating thing that's really interesting is that people who struggle most with ambiguity tend to have a larger stratum. And that's a part of the brain region that's responsible for fuel and reward for predictability. So just think about that. There's kind of this relationship, and you wonder kind of in the future, you know, if brain studies of entrepreneurs that were great risk takers, that entrepreneurs that could, you know, survive and thrive under ambiguity, if their striatums were smaller than risk-averse people. So it's so interesting how you know, the brain itself feeds into the ambiguity and the aversion we feel. I'm curious, Bridget, if you have any thoughts around where this aversion to ambiguity might actually come from?
Yeah, well, in addition to the fact that the structure of our brain may in fact influence, maybe I have a really large, what's it called, stratum?
Yeah.
Stratum? Yeah, maybe my aversion to ambiguity is due to a structural component of my brain. And maybe yours is smaller. Yeah. Who knows, right? But the point is, even that is not destiny. You know, even the structure of our brain is not destiny. But to your question about where does it come from, in addition to perhaps the way our brain is structured, I think our life experiences certainly play into this, right? And if you think about, we all go to school, you know, and what is school about, particularly early on? It's about getting the right answer. It's really not about gray. Like 2 + 2 = 4. It's not 5. There's no gray about that. And you're rewarded in school for answering things correctly. And really, it's not something I don't think we're typically, and I say typically, rewarded for seeing paradoxes and nuances and grays, right? So I wonder if just our educational shaping early on, at least in elementary school, contributes to this aversion to ambiguity. And then, you know, you think about from an evolutionary perspective, our ancestors, was it in their best interest to want to predict with certainty? And the answer is yes, because their very survival in the day to day depended on that, right? So if you could predict which foods would kill you and which ones wouldn't when you were foraging, that was extraordinarily helpful. And even apparently studies looking at monkeys, that they too have this preference, this aversion, shall we say, for ambiguity and this preference for predictability. Mm. So, you know, we come by it honestly, right? And I'm wondering then, Irvin, how have you noticed this aversion to ambiguity, or have you, showing up in the clients that you've worked with?
I've noticed that it shows up in a few different ways. I think there are clients that I know who hide it and then hide it with some rationalization. So I have clients who I've noticed who are avoiding a decision. And this decision is, I think there's a lot of fear around the decision that what if I get it wrong? And the way they rationalize it is by saying, well, I'm just waiting for some more data, or I just have to wait for this to play out. And on the surface, that sounds absolutely reasonable. But when you dig a little bit deeper, really what's in is there's a fear of either getting it wrong. There's a fear of what the consequences or the outcomes will be. And so that absolutely in some paralyzes some people. And then there are others who really have a greater capacity for ambiguity and who are able to really sit with the tension.
Yeah.
And you just know that they know that the answer is not easy and they're okay with that. And there's just an ability just to sit with it and kind of like, okay, I know I have to make a decision and I'll know when, but this is not going to be perfect. And that's just the way it is.
Those are some interesting observations. I've noticed that too. Meaning some variance in my client's tolerance for ambiguity. And I'm thinking of a client that is facing, oh my gosh, so much ambiguity. Boy, does she have so many decisions that she needs to make, but she doesn't have enough information to make them. And it's not even clear if she gets the information, what the best course of action will be. And this is happening on multiple fronts. And her anxiety is palpable. And I think that's what I observe the most, is that when some leaders are dealing with ambiguity on multiple fronts, their anxiety level rises such that that then interferes with their ability, right, to sit with what is and to think clearly. because to your point, it's like they so want to get it right. They're paralyzed by what if I get it wrong? Yeah. So this is really important, and an aversion to ambiguity for the reasons we've just said can really get in our way. Is there anything we can do about it?
We have said up to this about the neuroplasticity, et cetera. And, you know, I came across this study, which was very interesting. It was kind of a review of literature from Furnham and Marks. They were studying what are the benefits to have more tolerance of ambiguity. What they found is that people who were more comfortable with ambiguity had greater life satisfaction. They experienced more positive emotions, feel less threatened by the environment to others, experience less anxiety. They are more entrepreneurial, better managers, take more risks, have greater self-confidence, and be more open to new experiences. And I was saying, I'll have some of that, please. I mean, it was like this list of, instead of the drug ad, everything going wrong, everything going right. So this is important. The point is, if we can change that, we really are impacting a lot of life satisfaction. And you can understand that because we have said before, we're in a VUCA world. That's not going to change. And so therefore, as humans, we really have to adapt to this environment, which is going to become the norm. And I think what's really encouraging is that there are a number of ways that we can help ourselves become more comfortable and have a less aversion. And there's three, I think, that maybe we might want to talk about today. One is just the use of a mindfulness practice. The second is focusing on process rather than outcomes. And the third is thinking in a way which I called probabilistically, which is talking about probability. Yeah. So let's look at mindfulness and how mindfulness might help us become more tolerant of ambiguity.
Yeah, that is such a great point. You know, just this morning in preparation for recording this conversation, I did a very brief mindfulness breathing practice. I set the timer for 30 seconds, literally. And I just, as I was breathing quite naturally in and out, I brought my attention to my breath and noticed what did the air feel like when it would enter into my nose and on the exhale, dropping my shoulders. And then just trying to be present in a non-judgmental way to whatever I notice, because mindfulness is about paying attention to whatever's going on in the present moment without judgment. And as I was breathing and just trying to mindfully pay attention to the breath, of course, I noticed what we always notice, which is my mind was filled with thoughts and wanted to carry me away time and time again. But you know what? I also noticed some anxiety that I wasn't aware of, kind of in my gut. So I became aware of sensations and some emotions and some thoughts. They weren't comfortable thoughts. Because you remember how I said at the beginning of this podcast that I'm dealing with some ambiguity myself? So when I took the time to be mindful and pay attention to the breath, the discomfort of that became apparent. And I tried to just sit with it. You know, I tried to notice it without becoming attached to it and just allowing it to come into my awareness and flow out. And that was really helpful to me today. And so I think any mindfulness practice can work, but in particular, a mindfulness practice where we are specifically working at becoming aware of in the present moment what's going on for us, not judging it, and sitting with the discomfort. Because again, isn't that what we've been talking about? That ambiguity can make us uncomfortable. And it's the aversion to ambiguity is the aversion to that discomfort. What if we sat with it and allowed it to just be? That might make a difference.
Yeah.
So what else, Irvin? I mean, that to me was really, really helpful. What's another strategy that you mentioned?
So I think the other one then is really zooming out and looking at where is our focus? Because I think sometimes our focus is rather than don't focus on making no right decisions, but rather on making the decisions right. So what I mean by that is, you know, at times, you know, we do live in an unpredictable world and we have wrong predictions. And, you know, it's impossible for everyone to predict everything perfectly. And we all have to make decisions with limited information at hand. So therefore, one of the best things, instead of really overly focusing on the outcomes, what will the outcomes be of this? It's really to say, what's the process that I'm using? And so many times the outcome's out of our control. There are no ways we can predict because there are things, but we can really focus on the process. So let me ground this a little bit. So we've got a podcast, and wouldn't it be wonderful if in our podcast we wanted to be international success with a legion of followers, and we could focus on that. We could say, oh, we want the outcome goal is for our podcast to go viral. But really, that's not in our control. There's a lot of different things that go into making a podcast successful. But instead of really fretting about that goal, what we could do is look at the process that we are doing, such as the metrics. How much time are we spending with each episode? How many episodes have we posted? How much research are we putting into each episode? How much feedback do we get? All of those things are within our control. And it's this process, and really then just give up this outcome, which is really beyond our control. And what's interesting is, you know, I was looking at some research by these two guys called Barron and Hersey, who were saying that as humans, we tend to have an outcome bias, in the sense of we tend to look at people and judge them by the outcomes rather than their process, which is really interesting. Mm. And it says, you know, kind of thinking about that, you know, if we're leaders in organizations where there is a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty, I think we can help embrace the ambiguity, both of ourselves and others, by really creating a culture that looks at process rather than outcomes. That really, have we good processes in place as we go about making a decision? And instead of putting all our focus on making the right decision, the perfect decision, it's are we going through good processes? And that really will help us establish a sense of control and a sense of we're doing everything we can in the face of the ambiguity.
I like that. I like that a lot. Because as you said, you can't control the outcome, but you sure can have a big control over the process by which you are seeking that outcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
Bridget, anything else? I think I mentioned as well about probabilities.
Yeah. Thinking in probabilities instead of certainties. Mm. Of course, if you think about it, right? Doesn't life teach us that nothing in life is certain except for death? Yep.
And taxes.
You can get away sometimes with not paying your taxes, but you can't get away from dying. I'll tell you that. And yet, you know, even though we know that intellectually, I don't think we live our lives like that. And we're just seeking certainties. Mm. And, you know, scientists are not trained like this. They're trained to think in probabilities. You're not going to hear a scientist say, oh, this is 100% proven, or this is 100% curable in all these situations. They'll talk like, well, here are the likely probabilities, right? And I think that's a really helpful way to look at things. And I don't think we typically do. And that's all about embracing the gray, right? And sort of evaluating the options in front of us in terms of what is most likely to lead to the outcome we want, what is least likely based on the information we have today, which may be imperfect and actually might be contradictory. But then we stay open to new information. And if we get new information, we have to update those probabilities, those outcomes. Maybe the outcome that seemed most likely to succeed in terms of the outcome we want or the option now is not very probable for us, right? And I had a good friend many years ago who had a life-threatening diagnosis. Mm. And I mean, it was incredibly anxiety producing for him. And when he met with his doctors, this is what he shared with me, what he learned from it, which, by the way, he's 100% okay now. It looked incredibly dicey there for a while, but it's a good news story in that regard. And when he met with his doctors, he was sharing with me that early on he was looking for certainty, and he would really ask them, you know, well, which option is going to lead to this outcome. And they would say, they would never say, well, this option is going to cure you, or this option. They'd say, we're going to lay out to you what the probabilities are, and you're going to have to make a choice based on imperfect data. And that's as good as it gets, basically. And he made his choice. It turned out well. But he said, what I learned from that is to really embrace this notion that when I have to make a hard decision, and that was the hardest decision he ever made in his life about what treatment option to pursue, because what was at stake was his life. He became paralyzed and highly anxious when he thought there was one right option and he just had to find what that was. And if he didn't find it, all was lost. Once he gave that up, he said, I was free. And he says, I now apply that to other circumstances. And I thought, wow, what a great, you know, what a great lesson to learn. So can we kind of change up the way we look at decision-making, particularly the tough decisions? You know, Irvin, you mentioned early on, like some of the toughest decisions, like, should we get married? Should we have a kid? Should we do this? There are no hard and fast, clear yes or no's. And we'll never make those decisions, or we'll be racked with anxiety about them if we look at it that way. So I like that. Think in probabilities, not in certainties.
I love that as well. Yeah, it does. Such a powerful example. Yeah. And I think at times you do get caught up in that thinking there's one right answer, and at times there's not. Yeah.
Well, you're pretty good at ambiguity, you said. But what's resonating for you most in terms of these different ways of growing our tolerance?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is I'm thinking of a client who I had a few years ago, had some really big decisions. The company was going through a lot of change. Independently, they had decided that they wanted to take up some mindful practices, and they had been doing some meditation and different things like that. And I remember having a really interesting conversation about a real tough decision. This was around a merger. It was not clear. It wasn't one of these, this is absolutely, you know, there was downsides and upsides.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying to me, you know, this practice of a morning meditation or focus has really impacted this. I'm dealing with this differently. And I was saying, tell me more, because I was curious. And he said, I know before that I would rush to make a decision to avoid feeling the discomfort I feel. And I said, this time around, it feels different. It feels like I have just a tolerance for sitting in discomfort longer and not feeling I have to prematurely make a decision. And I think, you know, you mentioned about the mindfulness, and I think that is the advantage of the mindfulness. It is that we can be present to something for longer and not feel, I think one of the, you know, we've talked about this before in systems thinking, that when we feel anxiety and stress, one of the things is we want to act quickly. We want to get out of that feeling. We want to resolve the ambiguity, make a decision, do something. And I think this ability just to sit with for a longer period really invites a kind of a greater clarity in that, oh, okay, now I'm seeing a little bit of where I should go. So that for me was really powerful.
That's so powerful. Yeah. Wow. And I definitely relate to that. And I think any self-observation practice goes a long way towards helping us do exactly what your client did there. You know, part of what's really resonating with me, and I know this is so important in the organizations where I coach folks. And that's that strategy you mentioned of paying attention to process and outcome, not just outcome, right? Because you can't always control the outcome. And I think that's so important because, like, we all know sometimes leaders who get results and get outcomes, but the way they do it ain't so good.
Yeah.
And yet I think most organizations tolerate this because they're so outcome focused. It's almost like, you can do anything. You can behave really poorly and annoy everybody. But if you bring in a client, you're good as gold, right? So I think that really matters. I have a client and he listens to this podcast regularly. So he's gonna know that I'm talking about him. His company engages in a yearly strategic planning process. And he, over time, has learned a particular process that really works. And he calls it the no blood on the walls strategic planning process. And what he means by that is that previous to figuring out this process, the offsites where they determined priorities and who would get what and how to allocate resources, they became pretty testy. Mm. And so while there wasn't actual blood on the wall, sometimes it felt like that. So to the point about process matters as much as outcomes, and we can control those a lot better. I think that helps with it. So I resonate with that a lot. What about a way to put this into practice? What would you offer?
We've just come off three kind of really interesting practices. So you may well think, oh, let me try one of those. But I think also, I think it's important for us to become even more aware of our relationship to ambiguity. So I think I would just invite our listeners to, you know, what is your level of comfort or discomfort with ambiguity? And so, for example, like, how do you react when you face ambiguous problems, information, or expectations? So just think about in the past year or presently, are you sitting on a decision that is very ambiguous? And think about, what are the emotions coming up for you? Well, how do you face that? What is that causing within you? Is it fear? Is it frustration? What is it? Or is it excitement even that you know, it depends your tolerance. And then, you know, do you embrace ambiguity as something of learning and creativity, or do you avoid it? And notice that, am I avoiding it because I need control? And because I can't control this, it's frustrating. And then how do you cope with the stress and emotions that ambiguity brings up? Is it a trigger for you? Have you a way, we just mentioned that, of sitting with it? Or is the impulse within you the kind of like, I need to get rid of this as quickly as possible? All of that is great learning. And I think when we notice that, then we can put on top of that maybe one of the three ways we've talked about to help us maybe expand our tolerance of ambiguity.
Mm, I love that. That's so, so helpful. This has been a great conversation. I have definitely learned something, Irvin. And as I shared, you know, a few moments ago, that mindfulness practice I did this morning has really shifted something for me in terms of how I'm currently dealing with my own ambiguity. And so, you know, we've covered a lot of ground and looked at, from a neuroscience point of view, why do so many of us have an aversion to ambiguity? We come by it through honest means. You know, there's an evolutionary aspect to it. There's a life-shaping aspect to it. Heck, maybe our brain is structured such that we tend to be more averse to ambiguity. So, you know, all is not lost, though, because we've shared with our listeners some strategies, and hopefully they have found one or two that they can put into practice. And, you know, what's at stake here? I mean, if we can become more comfortable with ambiguity, and I was just amazed at what you shared from that study, that people who do have greater life satisfaction, they feel less threatened by their environment, they're more creative. They're better managers. I mean, right? What more could we want for ourselves with all of that at stake? Listeners, I hope you have found something in here that will help you face into ambiguity from a place of greater strength. And Irvin, let's tell them what's on tap for next time. Do you remember?
I do. I'm really excited. I cannot wait to get into this episode. We're going to talk about workplace politics, and the episode's called Workplace Politics Played Right. So if you're sitting there thinking, oh my God, workplace politics, and you think of all those images, we're going to get into a great conversation about
it. Yeah, talk about aversion.
No, totally.
All right, well, Irvin, thank you once again for a delightful
Likewise.
Conversation. Take Bye care, now. Folks.